The matter particles obey what is called Pauli's exclusion principle. This was discovered in 1925 by an Austrian physicist, Wolfgang Pauli, for which he received the Nobel Prize in 1945. He was the archetype theoretical physicist. It was said of him that even his presence in the same town could make experiments go wrong. Pauli's exclusion principle says that two similar particles cannot exist in the same state. That is, they cannot have both the same position and the same velocity within the limits given by the uncertainty principle. The exclusion principle is crucial because it explains why matter particles do not collapse to a state of very high density under the influence of the forces produced by the particles of spin 0, 1, and 2. If the matter particles have very nearly the same positions, they must have different velocities, which means that they will not stay in the same position for long. If the world had been created without the exclusion principle, quarks would not form separate well-defined protons and neutrons, nor would these, together with electrons, form separate well-defined atoms. They would all collapse to form a roughly uniform dense soup. A proper understanding of the electron and other spin half-particles did not come until 1928, when a theory was proposed by Paul Dirac, who later was elected to the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematics at Cambridge, the same professorship that Newton had once held and that I now hold. Dirac's theory was the first of its kind that was consistent with both quantum mechanics and the special theory of relativity. It explained mathematically why the electron had spin half, that is, why it didn't look the same if you turned it through only one complete revolution, but did if you turned it through two revolutions. It is also predicted that the electron should have a partner, an anti-electron or positron. The discovery of the positron in 1932 confirmed Dirac's theory and led to his being awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1933. We now know that every particle has an antiparticle with which it can annihilate. In the case of the force-carrying particles, the antiparticles are the same as the particles themselves. There could be whole anti-worlds and anti-people made out of antiparticles. However, if you meet yourself or your anti-self, don't shake hands. You would both vanish in a great flash of light. The question of why there seem to be so many more particles than antiparticles around us is extremely important, and I shall return to it later in the chapter. In quantum mechanics, the forces or interactions between matter particles are all supposed to be carried by particles of integer spin, 0, 1, or 2. What happens is that a matter particle, such as an electron or a quark, emits a force-carrying particle. The recoil from this emission changes the velocity of the matter particle. The force-carrying particle then collides with another matter particle and is absorbed. This collision changes the velocity of the second particle, just as if there had been a force between the two matter particles. It is an important property of the force-carrying particles that they do not obey the exclusion principle. Now, this means that there is no limit to the number that can be exchanged, and so they can give rise to a strong force. However, if the force-carrying particles have a high mass, it will be difficult to produce and exchange them over a large distance. So the forces that they carry will have only a short range. On the other hand, if the force-carrying particles have no mass of their own, the forces will be long range. The force-carrying particles exchanged between matter particles are said to be virtual particles because, unlike real particles, they cannot be directly detected by a particle detector. We know they exist because they do have a measurable effect. They give rise to forces between matter particles. Particles of spin 0, 1, or 2 do also exist in some circumstances as real particles when they can be directly detected. They then appear to us as what a classical physicist would call waves, such as waves of light or gravitational waves. They may sometimes be emitted when matter particles interact with each other by exchanging virtual force-carrying particles. For example, the electric repulsive force between two electrons is due to the exchange of virtual photons, which can never be directly detected. But if one electron moves past another, real photons may be given off, which we detect as light waves. Force-carrying particles can be grouped into four categories according to the strength of the force that they carry and the particles with which they interact. It should be emphasized that this division into four classes is man-made. It is convenient for the construction of partial theories, but it may not correspond to anything deeper. Ultimately, most physicists hope to find a unified theory that will explain all four forces as different aspects of a single force. Indeed, many would say this is the prime goal of physics today. Recently, successful attempts have been made to unify three of the four categories of force, and I shall describe these in this chapter. The question of the unification of the remaining category, gravity, we shall leave till later. The first category is the gravitational force. This force is universal. That is, every particle feels the force of gravity according to its mass or energy. Gravity is the weakest of the four forces by a long way. It is so weak that we would not notice it at all were it not for two special properties that it has. It can act over large distances, and it is always attractive. This means that the very weak gravitational forces between the individual particles in two large bodies, such as the Earth and the Sun, can all add up to produce a significant force. The other three forces are either short-range, or are sometimes attractive and sometimes repulsive, so they tend to cancel out. In the quantum mechanical way of looking at the gravitational field, the force between two matter particles is pictured as being carried by a particle of spin 2 called the graviton. This has no mass of its own, so the force that it carries is long range. The gravitational force between the Sun and the Earth is ascribed to the exchange of gravitons between the particles that make up these two bodies. Although the exchanged particles are virtual, they certainly do produce a measurable effect. They make the Earth orbit the Sun. Grill gravitons make up what classical physicists would call gravitational waves, which are very weak, and so difficult to detect that they have never yet been observed. The next category is the electromagnetic force, which interacts with electrically charged particles like electrons and quarks, but not with uncharged particles such as gravitons. It is much stronger than the gravitational force. The electromagnetic force between two electrons is about a million, 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 million. That is, one with 42 zeros after it, times bigger than the gravitational force. However, there are two kinds of electric charge, positive and negative. The force between two positive charges is repulsive, as is the force between two negative charges. But the force is attractive between a positive and a negative charge. A large body, such as the Earth or the Sun, contains nearly equal numbers of positive and negative charges. Thus, the attractive and repulsive forces between the individual particles nearly cancel each other out, and there is very little net electromagnetic force. However, on the small scales of atoms and molecules, electromagnetic forces dominate. The electromagnetic attraction between negatively charged electrons and positive charged protons in the nucleus causes the electrons to orbit the nucleus of the atom, just as gravitational attraction causes the Earth to orbit the Sun. The electromagnetic attraction is pictured as being caused by the exchange of large numbers of virtual massless particles of spin 1 called photons. Again, the photons that are exchanged are virtual particles. However, when an electron changes from one allowed orbit to another one nearer to the nucleus, energy is released and a real photon is emitted, which can be observed as visible light by the human eye if it has the right wavelength or by a photon detector such as photographic film. Equally, if a real photon collides with an atom, it may move an electron from an orbit nearer the nucleus to one farther away. This uses up the energy of the photon, so it is absorbed. The third category is called the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactivity and which acts on all matter particles of spin half, but not on particles of spin 0, 1, or 2, such as photons and gravitons. The weak nuclear force was not well understood until 1967, when Abdus Salam at Imperial College London and Stephen Weinberg at Harvard both proposed theories that unified this interaction with the electromagnetic force, just as Maxwell had unified electricity and magnetism about 100 years earlier. They suggested that in addition to the photon, there were three other spin 1 particles known collectively as massive vector bosons that carried the weak force. These are called W plus, W minus, and Z naught, and each had a mass of around 100 GeV. GeV stands for a giga electron volt, or 1,000 million electron volts. The Weinberg-Salam theory exhibits a property known as spontaneous symmetry breaking. This means that what appear to be a number of completely different particles at low energies are in fact found to be all the same type of particle, only in different states. At high energies, all these particles behave similarly. The effect is rather like the behavior of a roulette ball on a roulette wheel. At high energies, when the wheel is spun quickly, the ball behaves in essentially only one way. It rolls round and round, but as the wheel slows, the energy of the ball decreases, and eventually the ball drops into one of the 37 slots in the wheel. In other words, at low energies, there are 37 different states in which the ball can exist. If, for some reason, we could only observe the ball at low energies, we would then think that there were 37 different types of ball. In the Weinberg-Salam theory, at energies much greater than 100 GeV, the three new particles and the photon would all behave in a similar manner. But at the lower particle energies that occur in most normal situations, this symmetry between the particles would be broken. W plus, W minus, and Z naught would acquire large masses, making the forces they carry have a very short range. At the time that Salam and Weinberg proposed the theory, few people believed them, and particle accelerators were not powerful enough to reach the energies 100 GeV required to produce the real W plus, W minus, or Z naught particles. However, over the next 10 years or so, the other predictions of the theory at lower energies agreed so well with experiment that in 1979, Salam and Weinberg were awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics, together with Sheldon Glashow, also at Harvard, who had suggested similar unified theories of the electromagnetic and weak nuclear forces. The Nobel Committee was spared the embarrassment of having made a mistake by the discovery in 1983 at CERN, the European Center for Nuclear Research, of the three massive partners of the photon with the correct predicted masses and other properties. Carlo Rubbia, who led the team of several hundred physicists that made the discovery, received the Nobel Prize in 1984, along with Simon von der Meer, the CERN engineer who developed the antimatter storage system employed. It's very difficult to make a mark in experimental physics these days unless you are already at the top. The fourth category is the strong nuclear force, which holds the quarks together in the proton and neutron, and holds the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus of an atom. It is believed that this force is carried by another spin 1 particle called the gluon, which interacts only with itself and with the quarks. The strong nuclear force has a curious property called confinement. It always binds particles together in combinations that have no color. One cannot have a single quark on its own because it would have a color, red, green, or blue. Instead, a red quark has to be joined to a green and a blue quark by a string of gluons. Red plus green plus blue equals white. Such a triplet consists or constitutes a proton or a neutron. Another possibility is a pair consisting of a quark and an antiquark. Red plus anti-red, or green plus anti-green, or blue plus anti-blue equals white. Such combinations make up the particles known as mesons, which are unstable because the quark and the antiquark can annihilate each other, producing electrons and other particles. Similarly, confinement prevents one having a single gluon its own, because gluons also have color. Instead, one has to have a collection of gluons whose colors add up to white. Such a collection forms an unstable particle called a glue ball. The fact that confinement prevents one from observing an isolated quark or gluon might seem to make the whole notion of quarks and gluons as particles somewhat metaphysical. However, there is another property of the strong nuclear force called asymptotic freedom. It makes the concept of quarks and gluons well-defined. At normal energies, the strong nuclear force is indeed strong, and it binds the quarks tightly together. However, experiments with large particle accelerators indicate that at high energies, the strong force becomes much weaker, and the quarks and gluons behave almost like free particles. Several almost free quarks were produced and gave rise to the jets of tracks that you'll see in the picture in my book. The success of the unification of the electromagnetic and weak nuclear forces led to a number of attempts to combine these two forces with the strong nuclear force into what is called a grand unified theory, or GUT. This title is rather an exaggeration. The resultant theories are not all that grand, nor are they fully unified, as they do not include gravity. Nor are they really complete theories, because they contain a number of parameters whose values cannot be predicted from the theory, but have to be chosen to fit in with an experiment. Nevertheless, they may be a step toward a complete, fully unified theory. The basic idea of guts is as follows. As we mentioned above, the strong nuclear force gets weaker at high energies. On the other hand, the electromagnetic and weak forces, which are not asymptotically free, get strong at high energies. At some very high energy, called the grand unification energy, these three forces would all have the same strength, and so could just be different aspects of a single force. The guts also predicts that at this energy, the different spin half-matter particles, like quarks and electrons, would also all be essentially the same, thus achieving another unification. The value of the grand unification energy is not very well known, but it would probably have to be at least 1,000,000,000,000 GeV. The present generation of particle accelerators can collide particles at energies of about 100 GeV, and machines are planned that would raise this to a few thousand GeV. But a machine that was powerful enough to accelerate particles to the grand unification energy would have to be as big as the solar system, and would be unlikely to be funded in the present economic climate. Thus, it is impossible to test grand unified theories directly in the lab. However, just as in the case of the electromagnetic and weak unified theory, there are low-energy consequences of the theory that can be tested. The most interesting of these is the prediction that protons, which make up much of the mass of ordinary matter, can spontaneously decay into lighter particles such as anti-electrons. The reason this is possible is that at the grand unification energy, there is no essential difference between a quark and an anti-electron. The three quarks inside a proton normally do not have enough energy to change into anti-electrons, but very occasionally one of them may acquire sufficient energy to make the transition, because the uncertainty principle means that the energy of the quarks inside the proton cannot be fixed exactly. The proton would then decay. The probability of a quark gaining sufficient energy is so low that one is likely to have to wait at least 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 years. That's 1 followed by 30 zeros. This is much longer than the time since the Big Bang, which is a mere 10,000 million years, or thereabouts. That's 1 followed by 10 zeros. Thus, one might think that the possibility of spontaneous proton decay could not be tested experimentally. However, one can increase one's chances of detecting a decay by observing a large amount of matter containing a very large number of protons. If, for example, one observed a number of protons equal to 1 followed by 31 zeros for a period of 1 year, one would expect, according to the simplest gut, to observe more than one proton decay. A number of such experiments have been carried out, but none have yielded definite evidence of proton or neutron decay. One experiment used 8,000 tons of water and was performed in the Morton Salt Mine in Ohio to avoid other events taking place caused by cosmic rays that might be confused with proton decay. Since no spontaneous proton decay had been observed during the experiment, one can calculate that the probable life of the proton must be greater than 10,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 years. In other words, 1 with 31 zeros. This is longer than the lifetime predicted by the simplest grand unified theory. But there are more elaborate theories in which the predicted lifetimes are longer. Still more sensitive experiments involving even larger quantities of matter will be needed to test them. Even though it's very difficult to observe spontaneous proton decay, it may be that our very existence is a consequence of the reverse process, the production of protons, or more simply, of quarks, from an initial situation in which there were no more quarks than antiquarks, which is the most natural way to imagine the universe starting out. Matter on the Earth is made up mainly of protons and neutrons, which in turn are made up of quarks. There are no antiprotons or antineutrons made up from antiquarks, except for a few that physicists produce in large particle accelerators. We have evidence from cosmic rays that the same is true for all the matter in our galaxy. There are no antiprotons or antineutrons apart from a small number that are produced as particle-antiparticle pairs in high-energy collisions. If there were large regions of antimatter in our galaxy, we would expect to observe large quantities of radiation from the borders between the regions of matter and antimatter, where many particles will be colliding with their antiparticles, annihilating each other, and giving off high-energy radiation. We have no direct evidence as to whether the matter in other galaxies is made up of protons and neutrons or antiprotons and antineurons. But it must be one or the other. There cannot be a mixture in a single galaxy, because in that case, we would again observe a lot of radiation from annihilations. We therefore believe that all galaxies are composed of quarks rather than antiquarks, and it seems implausible that some galaxies should be matter and some should be antimatter. Why should there be so many more quarks than antiquarks? Why are there not equal numbers of each? It is certainly fortunate for us that the numbers are unequal, because if they had been the same, nearly all the quarks and antiquarks would have annihilated each other in the early universe and left a universe filled with radiation but hardly any matter. There would then have been no galaxies, stars, or planets on which human life could have developed. Luckily, grand unified theories may provide an explanation of why the universe should now contain more quarks than antiquarks, even if it started out with equal numbers of each. As we've seen, guts allow quarks to change into anti-electrons at high energy. They also allow the reverse processes, antiquarks turning into electrons, and electrons and anti-electrons turning into antiquarks and quarks. There was a time in the very early universe when it was so hot that the particle energies would have been high enough for these transformations to take place. But why should that lead to more quarks than antiquarks? The reason is that the laws of physics are not quite the same for particles and antiparticles. Up to 1956, it was believed that the laws of physics obeyed each of three separate symmetries called CP and T. The symmetry C means that the laws are the same for particles and antiparticles. The symmetry P means that the laws are the same for any situation and its mirror image. The mirror image of a particle spinning in a right-handed direction is one spinning in a left-handed direction. The symmetry T means that if you reverse the direction of motion of all particles and antiparticles, the system should go back to what it was at earlier times. In other words, the laws are the same in the forward and the backward directions of time. In 1956, two American physicists, Zhong Dao Li and Chen Ying Yang, suggested that the weak force does not in fact obey the symmetry P. In other words, the weak force would make the universe develop in a different way from the way in which the mirror image of the universe would develop. That same year, a colleague, Shan Xing Wu, proved their prediction correct. She did this by lining up the nuclei of radioactive atoms in a magnetic field so that they were all spinning in the same direction, and showed that the electrons were given off more in one direction than another. The following year, Li and Yang received the Nobel Prize for their idea. It was also found that the weak force did not obey the symmetry C. That is, it would cause a universe composed of antiparticles to behave differently from our universe. Nevertheless, it seemed that the weak force did obey the combined symmetry CP. That is, the universe would develop in the same way as its mirror image if, in addition, every particle was swapped with its antiparticle. However, in 1964, two more Americans, J.W. Cronin and Val Fitch, discovered that even the CP symmetry was not obeyed in the decay of certain particles called K-mesons. Cronin and Fitch eventually received the Nobel Prize for their work in 1980. A lot of prizes have been awarded for showing that the universe is not as simple as we might have thought. There is a mathematical theorem that says that any theory that obeys quantum mechanics and relativity must always obey the combined symmetry CPT. In other words, the universe would have to behave the same if one replaced particles by antiparticles, took the mirror image, and also reversed the direction of time. But Cronin and Fitch showed that if one replaces particles by antiparticles and takes the mirror image, but does not reverse the direction of time, then the universe does not behave the same. The laws of physics, therefore, must change if one reverses the direction of time. They do not obey the symmetry T. Certainly, the early universe does not obey the symmetry T. As time runs forward, the universe expands. If it ran backward, the universe would be contracting. And since there are forces that do not obey the symmetry T, it follows that as the universe expands, these forces could cause more anti-electrons to turn into quarks than electrons into antiquarks. Then, as the universe expanded and cooled, the antiquarks would annihilate with the quarks. But since there would be more quarks than antiquarks, a small excess of quarks would remain. It is these that make up the matter we see today, and out of which we ourselves are made. Thus, our very existence could be regarded as a confirmation of grand unified theories, though a qualitative one only. The uncertainties are such that One cannot predict the numbers of quarks that will be left after the annihilation, or even whether it will be quarks or antiquarks that would remain. Had it been an excess of antiquarks, however, we would simply have named antiquarks quarks and quarks antiquarks. Grand unified theories do not include the force of gravity. This does not matter too much because gravity is such a weak force that its effects can usually be neglected when we are dealing with elementary particles or atoms. However, the fact that it is both long-range and always attractive means that its effects all add up. So for a sufficiently large number of matter particles, gravitational forces can dominate over all other forces. This is why it is gravity that determines the evolution of the universe. Even for objects the size of stars, the attractive force of gravity can win over all the other forces and cause the star to collapse. My work in the 1970s focused on the black holes that can result from such stellar collapse and the intense gravitational fields around them. It was this that led to the first hints of how the theories of quantum mechanics and general relativity might affect each other, a glimpse of the shape of a quantum theory of gravity yet to come. Chapter 6. Black Holes. The term black hole is of very recent origin. It was coined in 1969 by the American scientist John Wheeler as a graphic description of an idea that goes back at least 200 years to a time when there were two theories about light. One, which Newton favored, was that it was composed of particles. The other was that it was made of waves. We now know that really both theories are correct. By the wave-particle duality of quantum mechanics, light can be regarded as both a wave and a particle. Under the theory that light is made up of waves, it was not clear how it would respond to gravity. But if light is composed of particles, one might expect them to be affected by gravity in the same way that cannonballs, rockets, and planets are. At first, people thought that particles of light traveled infinitely fast, so gravity would not have been able to slow them down. But the discovery by Rumer that light travels at a finite speed meant that gravity might have an important effect. On this assumption, a Cambridge don, John Mitchell, wrote a paper in 1783 in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London, in which he pointed out that a star that was sufficiently massive and compact would have such a strong gravitational field that light could not escape. Any light emitted from the surface of the star would be dragged back by the star's gravitational attraction before it could get very far. Mitchell suggested that there might be a large number of stars like this. Although we would not be able to see them because the light from them would not reach us, we would still feel their gravitational attraction. Such objects are what we now call black holes, because that is what they are, black voids in space. A similar suggestion was made a few years later by the French scientist, the Marquis de Laplace, apparently independently of Mitchell. Interestingly enough, Laplace included it in only the first and second editions of his book, The System of the World, and left it out of later editions. Perhaps he decided that it was a crazy idea. Also, the particle theory of light went out of favor during the 19th century. It seemed that everything could be explained by the wave theory, and according to the whole wave theory, it was not clear that light would be affected by gravity at all. In fact, it is not really consistent to treat light like cannonballs in Newton's theory of gravity, because the speed of light is fixed. A cannonball fired upward from the Earth will be slowed down by gravity and will eventually stop and fall back. A photon, however, must continue upward at a constant speed. How, then, can Newtonian gravity affect light? A consistent theory of how gravity affects light did not come along until Einstein proposed general relativity in 1915. And even then, it was a long time before the implications of the theory for massive stars were understood. To understand how a black hole might be formed, we first need an understanding of the life cycle of a star. A star is formed when a large amount of gas, mostly hydrogen, starts to collapse on itself due to its gravitational attraction. As it contracts, the atoms of the gas collide with each other more and more frequently and at greater and greater speeds. The gas heats up. Eventually, the gas will be so hot that when the hydrogen atoms collide, they no longer bounce off each other, but instead coalesce to form helium. The heat released in this reaction, which is like a controlled hydrogen bomb explosion, is what makes the star shine. This additional heat also increases the pressure of the gas until it is sufficient to balance the gravitational attraction, and the gas stops contracting. It's a bit like a balloon. There's a balance between the pressure of the air inside, which is trying to make the balloon expand, and the tension in the rubber, which is trying to make the balloon smaller. Stars will remain stable like this for a long time, with heat from the nuclear reactions balancing the gravitational attraction. Eventually, however, the star will run out of its hydrogen and other nuclear fuels. Paradoxically, the more fuel a star starts off with, the sooner it runs out. This is because the more massive the star is, the hotter it needs to be to balance its gravitational attraction. And the hotter it is, the faster it will use up its fuel. Our sun has probably got enough fuel for another 5,000 million years or so, but more massive stars can use up their fuel in as little as 100 million years, much less than the age of the universe. When a star runs out of fuel, it starts to cool off and so to contract. What might happen to it then was first understood only at the end of the 1920s. In 1928, an Indian graduate student set sail for England to study at Cambridge with the British astronomer Sir Arthur Eddington, an expert on general relativity. According to some accounts, a journalist told Eddington in the early 1920s that he had heard there were only three people in the world who understood general relativity. Eddington paused, then replied, "I'm trying to think who the third person is." During his voyage from India, this man, Chandra Reshkar, worked out how big a star could be and still support itself against its own gravity after it had used up all its fuel. The idea was this. When the star becomes small, the matter particles get very near each other, and so according to the Pauli exclusion principle, they must have very different velocities. This makes them move away from each other, and so tends to make the star expand. A star can therefore maintain itself at a constant radius by a balance between the attraction of gravity and the repulsion that arises from the exclusion principle, just as earlier in its life gravity was balanced by the heat. Chandrasekhar realized, however, that there is a limit to the repulsion that the exclusion principle can provide. The theory of relativity limits the maximum difference in the velocities of the matter particles in the star to the speed of light. This means that when the star got sufficiently dense, the repulsion caused by the exclusion principle would be less than the attraction of gravity. Chandrasekhar calculated that a cold star of more than about 1.5 times the mass of the sun would not be able to support itself against its own gravity. This mass is now known as the Chandrasekhar limit. A similar discovery was made about the same time by the Russian scientist Lev Davidovich Landau. This had serious implications for the ultimate fate of massive stars. If a star's mass is less than the Chandrasekhar limit, it can eventually stop contracting and settle down to a possible final state as a white dwarf, with a radius of a few thousand miles and a density of hundreds of tons per cubic inch. A white dwarf is supported by the exclusion principle, repulsion between the electrons in its matter. We observe a large number of these white dwarf stars. One of the first to be discovered is a star that is orbiting around Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky. Landau pointed out that there was another possible final state for a star, also with a limiting mass of about 1 or 2 times the mass of the sun, but much smaller even than a white dwarf. These stars would be supported by the exclusion principle, repulsion between neutrons and protons, rather than between electrons. They were therefore called neutron stars. They would have a radius of only 10 miles, or thereabouts, and a density of hundreds of millions of tons per cubic inch. At the time they were first predicted, there was no way the neutron stars could be observed. They were not actually detected until much later. Stars with masses above the Chandrasekhar limit, on the other hand, have a big problem when they come to the end of their fuel. In some cases, then they may explode or manage to throw off enough matter to reduce their mass below the limit and so avoid catastrophic gravitational collapse. But it was difficult to believe that this always happened, no matter how big the star. How would it know that it had to lose weight? And even if every star managed to lose enough mass to avoid collapse, what would happen if you added more mass to a white dwarf or neutron star to take it over the limit? Would it collapse to infinite density? Eddington was shocked by that implication, and he refused to believe Chandrasekhar's result. Eddington thought it was simply not possible that a star could collapse to a point. This was the view of most scientists. Einstein himself wrote a paper in which he claimed that stars would not shrink to zero size. The hostility of other scientists, particularly Eddington, his former teacher and the leading authority on the structure of stars, persuaded Chandrasekhar to abandon this line of work and turn instead to other problems in astronomy, such as the motion of star clusters. However, when he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 83, it was, at least in part, for his early work on the limiting mass of cold stars. Chandrasekhar had shown that the exclusion principle could not halt the collapse of a star more massive than the Chandrasekhar limit, but the problem of understanding what would happen to such a star, according to general relativity, was first solved by a young American, Robert Oppenheimer, in 1939. His result, however, suggested that there would be no observational consequences that could be detected by the telescopes of the day. Then World War II intervened, and Oppenheimer himself became closely involved in the atom bomb project. After the war, the problem of gravitational collapse was largely forgotten, as most scientists became caught up in what happens on the scale of the atom and its nucleus. In the 1960s, however, interest in the large-scale problems of astronomy and cosmology was revived by a greater increase in the number and range of astronomical observations brought about by the application of modern technology. Oppenheimer's work was then rediscovered and extended by a number of people. The picture that we now have from Oppenheimer's work is as follows. The gravitational field of the star changes the paths of light rays in space-time from what they would have been had the star not been present. The light cones, which indicate the path followed in space and time by flashes of light emitted from their tips, are bent slightly inward near the surface of the star. This can be seen in the bending of light from distant stars observed during an eclipse of the sun. As the star contracts, the gravitational field at its surface gets stronger and the light cones get bent inward more. This makes it more difficult for light from the star to escape. And then the light appears dimmer and redder to an observer at a distance. Eventually, when the star has shrunk to a certain critical radius, the gravitational field at the surface becomes so strong that the light cones are bent inward so much that light can no longer escape. According to the theory of relativity, nothing can travel faster than light. Thus, if light cannot escape, neither can anything else. Everything is dragged back by the gravitational field, so one has a set of events, a region of space-time, from which it is not possible to escape to reach a distant observer. This region is what we now call a black hole. Its boundary is called the event horizon, and it coincides with the paths of light rays that just failed to escape from the black hole. In order to understand what you would see if you were watching a star collapse to form a black hole, one has to remember that in the theory of relativity, there is no absolute time. Each observer has his own measure of time. The time for someone on a star will be different from that for someone at a distance because of the gravitational field of the star. Suppose an intrepid astronaut on the surface of the collapsing star, collapsing inward with it, sent a signal every second, according to his watch, to his spaceship orbiting around the star. At some time on his watch, say 11, the star would shrink below the critical radius of which the gravitational field becomes so strong nothing can escape, and his signals would no longer reach the spaceship. As 11 approached, his companions watching from the spaceship would find the intervals between successive signals from the astronaut getting longer and longer. But this effect would be very small before 10:59:59. They would have to wait until very slightly more than a second between the astronaut's 10:59:58 signal and the one that he sent when his watch read 10:59:59, but they would have to wait forever for the 11 o'clock signal. The light waves emitted from the surface of the star between 10:59:59 and 11 by the astronaut's watch would be spread out over an infinite period of time as seen from the spaceship. The time interval between the arrival of successive waves at the spaceship would get longer and longer, so the light from the star would appear redder and redder and fainter. Eventually, the star would be so dim that it could no longer be seen from the spaceship. All that would be left would be a black hole in space. The star would, however, continue to exert the same gravitational force on the spaceship, which would continue to orbit the black hole. This scenario is not entirely realistic, however, because of the following problem. Gravity gets weaker and farther you are from the star, so the gravitational force on our intrepid astronaut's feet would always be greater than the force on his head. This difference in the forces would stretch our astronaut out like spaghetti or tear him apart before the star had contracted to the critical radius at which the event horizon formed. However, we believe